And welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, August 21st, 2020. Here are some of your headlines. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy tells a Senate committee that the U.S. Postal Service will be able to process all of the nation's mail-in ballots in November. He calls it the number one priority. He took pointed questions from senators about operational changes at the agency. Critics say it slowed the mail and amounted to sabotage by the Trump administration. President Trump reacting to this week's Democratic National Convention, calling it the darkest and angriest and gloomiest convention in American history. Republicans start their convention on Monday. A private funeral at the White House for the president's brother Robert. We'll be talking with a White House Historical Association scholar about the history of these types of events held by a public family living in a public house. And two of the highest-profile defendants in the college admissions cheating scandal have been sentenced. Actress Lori Loughlin got 2 months in jail. Her husband, fashion designer Massimo Giannulli, received 5 months. The scandal involved the rich and famous paying large sums to get their children into prestigious universities. The Hill newspaper reporting, tensions flared on Friday as senators battled with Postmaster General Louis DeJoy and each other over reports of delayed mail and concerns about the looming November elections. Hearing was before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Before we get to the questions from senators, some of Louis DeJoy's opening statement. First, about the fiscal situation of the post office.
This year, the Postal Service will likely report a loss of more than $9 billion. Without change, our losses will only increase in the years to come. It is vital that Congress enact reform legislation that addresses our unaffordable retirement payments. Most importantly, Congress must allow the Postal Service to integrate our retiree health benefits program with Medicare, which is a common sense practice followed by all businesses that still offer retiree health care. It also must rationalize our pension funding payments. Legislative actions have been discussed and debated for years, but no action has been taken. I urge the Congress to expeditiously enact these reforms. I also urge the Congress to enact legislation that would provide the Postal Service with financial relief to account for the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on our financial condition.
Some of the changes originally ordered by Louis DeJoy to save money at the Postal Service include eliminating overtime from mail carriers, reducing post office hours, and removing postal boxes and some high-speed sorting machines. DeJoy suspended the changes until after the election, but today did not commit to restoring mailboxes or machines. In his opening statement today, he also sought to reassure senators that, nonetheless, all mail-in ballots will be delivered on time, so people's votes will be counted this November.
As we head into the election season, I want to assure this committee and the American public that the Postal Service is fully capable and committed to delivering the nation's election mail securely and on time. This sacred duty is my number one priority between now and Election Day.
And now some of the question and answer portion of today's hearing. Senator Ron Johnson, committee chair, Republican, probing deeper on that question of mail-in ballots and the capacity of the Postal Service to handle the expected increase this year due to voters' reluctance to vote in person because of the coronavirus pandemic.
In my opening statement, I remarked that 150 million pieces of or ballots would represent about 6% of weekly volume. I think in your written testimony, you said in terms of what's actually expected in terms of mail-in ballots, about 2%. Can you just talk about and assure the American public and this committee that the postal system has more than enough capacity to handle the number of ballots? It's really a matter of election officials understanding what delivery capabilities are?
Yes, sir. We have more. We deliver 433 million pieces of mail a day. So 150 million ballots, 160 million ballots over a course of a week is, a very, very small amount. Adequate capacity. Plus, mail volume is down, as you said, 13-14% this year. Plus, as I identified earlier in the week, we will have additional resources on standby. If everyone complies with the with the mail process that we've been identifying, there will be absolutely no issue. And there's slack in the system and additional processes that we will deploy in and around the election that will carry a good part of any deviations to get through. We are perfectly, the Postal Service stands ready. Our board of directors stand ready. With the expansion of the task force that I identified earlier in the week, yesterday we made the decision to establish a board, a bipartisan board committee to stand over the postals to interact with us as we move forward. We are very, very comfortable that we will achieve this mission, sir.
Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, questioned by Senator Ron Johnson, Republican, and committee chair. DeJoy is a former logistics executive and a large donor to President Trump and the Republican Party. DeJoy took office in mid-June. More questions from the senators. Here is Tom Carper, Democrat.
After the public uproar that we've seen here in my state and other states about delays and failure to deliver the mail, you committed to freeze additional operational changes until after the election. Good. But we're going to need more information than that, especially given reports that came out last night showing that you and your team are actually considering more extreme changes than those we've seen to date, including changes that will slow down the mail even further, post office and plant closings, massive service reductions to Alaska, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico, making mail more expensive to the U.S. citizens living there, price changes that would nearly double the cost for price changes that would double the cost of voting by mail, dramatic price hikes on packages that will disproportionately impact small businesses in rural communities that rely on the Postal Service while erasing your competitive advantage over FedEx and UPS. We need to be worried about this, and I am. I don't ask a lot of yes or no questions. I'm going to ask a couple today, and I'd ask you just give me a simple yes or no answer. We'll have an opportunity in responses for the record to expand on those, but I'm going to ask you for yes or no answers. Yes or no, are you considering the dramatic service changes that I just outlined, which we've just learned about in the last 48 hours, are you considering those dramatic service changes? Just yes or no.
Senator, there's a dramatic.
I'm asking for a yes or no answer.
We're considering dramatic changes to improve the service to the American people. Yes.
Yes or no, will you restore the mail collection or processing capacity that the Postal Service has lost in recent weeks during your tenure?
Senator, as I said, I did not direct that. I directed it. I stopped it. It's insignificant. It's not material to anything that we do. And we're sticking with where we're at right now.
Recently, the president was caught red-handed when he admitted to not wanting the Postal Service to have additional resources because the Postal Service would use these resources to enable election mail. And when asked about providing necessary relief, the president stated, quote, "If we don't make a deal, that is a deal with the Congress, that means they don't get the money, they being the Postal Service. That means they don't get universal mail-in voting. They just can't have it." No wonder we're somewhat skeptical and dubious. My understanding is you have had more than a passing acquaintance with this president. My understanding, you've been a huge supporter financially of the president. My understanding is when you're going to have a convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, you were heavily involved in leading the raising of money for that convention. No wonder we're a little bit skeptical about this when we have a president talking down the Postal Service, talking down vote by mail. Another yes or no. And you can expand on the record on this. Yes or no. Will you remain independent of the president and this administration and make service decisions that support the American people first? Will you? The services that support the American people having fast, efficient, and affordable mail service, especially with regard to mail-in ballots. Will you remain independent of this administration? That's it. Will you remain independent?
Yes, we'll remain independent of this
administration. Thank you very much.
Senator Tom Carper, Democrat from Delaware, questioning Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a virtual hearing today by the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. The Postmaster General testifies on Monday before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Our live coverage starts 10 a.m. Eastern on C-SPAN 2 television, on the free C-SPAN radio app, or listen online at cspan.org. The U.S. House meets Saturday to consider a bill to provide the Postal Service with $25 billion and prohibit operational changes, quote, that would impede prompt, reliable, and efficient service. such as removing mail sorting machines and mailboxes. The bill would also require the Postal Service to treat election mail as first-class mail. Today, the House Rules Committee met to set the rules for floor debate. The committee chair is Democrat Jim McGovern.
There was no rationale for making it tougher to count ballots, unless you want fewer ballots to count. We should be encouraging every eligible American to vote this November. But apparently the president believes that more people voting makes it less likely that he gets a second term. Now, I don't know if the president will win in November, but I do know this. Every legal ballot should count, whether it's cast for Donald Trump, Joe Biden, or anyone else. That is why we're here today considering H.R. 8015, the Delivering for America Act. This legislation would reverse these changes and restore operations back to where they were on January 1st. It requires the Postal Service to treat all official election mail as first-class mail, and it provides $25 billion in funding for the Postal Service, which will help support its more than 633,000 employees. My colleagues, this is a five-alarm fire for our democracy. We need the boxes back. We need the sorting machines back. We need to respect the men and women who work for the Postal Service. We need additional funds and to support the Postal Service. And we need to reverse this slowdown in delivery. It is clear that none of this will happen unless Congress passes this bill. That is why it is urgent that we act immediately.
Jim McGovern is the chairman of the House Rules Committee. The ranking Republican is Tom Cole.
There are two main provisions of this bill. First, the bill blocks any changes to Postal Service operations that have been implemented since January 1st of this year. And it prohibits the Postal Service from implementing any further changes until after the 1st of next year, or after COVID-19 public health emergency ends, whichever is later. Second, the bill infuses the Postal Service with an additional $25 billion in emergency funding. This amount matches what was previously passed as part of the Democrats' Partisan Heroes Act earlier this summer, and it's on top of $10 billion in borrowing authority that was signed into law as part of the Bipartisan CARES Act this spring. Unfortunately, though I'm certainly supportive of a strong and efficient and effective Postal Service, this bill misses the mark in so many ways. And it will ultimately make it harder to improve operations and ensure that the Postal Service is set on a steady course in the future. Majority's actions today seem based on the concerns that the Postal Service is somehow in danger of immediate collapse, or that it is somehow in danger of not being able to deliver election-related mail, including ballots. Neither of these theories is accurate. While there are long-term challenges at the Postal Service, and while the actions taken by Postmaster Louis DeJoy and his predecessors are intended to help address those challenges, the Postal Service has sufficient cash on hand to continue operating well into 2021. And Postmaster DeJoy has repeatedly said that the Postal Service can and will meet its obligation with respect to delivering election mail.
Congressman Tom Cole during today's House Rules Committee meeting held virtually. The committee voted along party lines to issue a closed rule for debate on this bill. Closed means no amendments allowed. There's going to be 2 hours of general debate before the votes. The House takes that up Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern. You can listen live here on C-SPAN Radio. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said this week the Senate is unlikely to vote on a standalone Postal Service bill. But the Republican majority there is working on a smaller coronavirus relief package that aides say will include $10 billion for the post office. On Wall Street today, the Dow is up 190, NASDAQ up 46, S&P up 11 to close at a new record, 33.97. Washington Today continues in a minute with Campaign 2020. And welcome back to Washington Today. A couple of other headlines. The House Ethics Committee formally admonishing Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz for a tweet that attempted to intimidate President Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen ahead of his testimony to Congress last year. The Ethics Committee did not find that Gaetz violated laws against witness tampering and obstruction of Congress. Attorney General William Barr says he would be vehemently opposed to any attempt to pardon former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. This after President Trump suggested he might consider the pardon. Snowden was charged under the Espionage Act in 2013 with disclosing details of highly classified government surveillance programs. He's been living in Russia. And Russian doctors gave dissident Alexei Navalny, who is in a coma after suspected poisoning, permission to be transferred abroad for medical treatment. Navalny is one of Russia President Vladimir Putin's toughest critics. And now to the U.S. presidential campaign. In a minute, you're going to hear President Trump's reaction to Joe Biden's speech at the Democratic National Convention. But first, here is a portion of what the Democratic nominee said Thursday night.
The current president has cloaked American darkness for much too long. Too much anger, too much fear, too much division. Here and now, I give you my word. If you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw on the best of us, not the worst. I will be an ally of the light, not the darkness. It's time for us, for we the people, to come together. And make no mistake, united we can and will overcome this season of darkness in America. We'll choose hope over fear, facts over fiction, fairness over privilege.
Part of Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's acceptance speech at Thursday night's Democratic National Convention. Biden was in his home state of Delaware. Today, President Trump gave his assessment while addressing a conservative activist group in Northern Virginia.
But over the last week, the Democrats held the darkest and angriest and gloomiest convention in American history. They spent four straight days attacking America as racist and a horrible country that must be redeemed. Joe Biden grimly declared a season of American darkness. And yet, look at what we've accomplished. Until the plague came in, look at what we've accomplished. And now we're doing it again. It's the most successful period of time in the history of our country from every standard. Look what we've accomplished. And now this plague comes in, and look at the way they talk. But look at what's happening, and look at how we're shooting up. We call it a super V. It's no longer a V. It's a super V. And they didn't think that could happen, and they're probably not happy about it. They want to punish America and its citizens instead of holding them high. Where Joe Biden sees American darkness, I see American greatness. We've seen heroic doctors and nurses racing into action to save lives. We've seen first responders helping strangers in need. We've seen the passage of historic legislation to save 50 million American jobs. We've mobilized American industry like never before. We've built military hospitals from scratch, produced life-saving therapies, and we're on track to develop the most incredible, from a standpoint of time, record time, vaccines. We have vaccines. You'll be reading about them very soon, way, way ahead of schedule, years ahead of schedule. This would have been where we are now, phase three trials, clinical trials. You wouldn't have been there in 2 or 3 years if you went back to another administration. It's time to reject the anger and the hate of the Democrat Party. We have the biggest election coming up of our lifetime.
President Trump before the annual meeting of the Council for National Policy held in Arlington, Virginia, just across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. Joe Biden's speech Thursday night accepting the Democratic presidential nomination was watched by 21.8 million people on TV, according to initial figures from Nielsen. Still, that's a 21% drop from when Hillary Clinton accepted the nomination 4 years ago. It's also a 38% drop from when President Trump accepted the Republican Party nomination from 4 years ago. With more on the Democratic convention and a look ahead to next week's Republican convention, Dan Balls, Washington Post chief political correspondent.
Jonathan, I thought it was a very strong speech, probably one of the best speeches the former vice president and now Democratic nominee has given in his very long career. You know, this had been a pretty successful convention up to last night, but all conventions eventually depend on the performance of the nominee. And so there are questions about, whether Biden was going to rise to that moment. And I think he did. I thought it was thematically strong. I thought there was enough policy in there, but not too much. And I thought the delivery was quite forceful. It answered questions that I think that the Trump campaign has tried to put out there that Biden's not quite up to this moment. I thought last night he was up to the moment. I'll say one other thing about it. This convention has reinvented what conventions will be in the future. It was out of necessity, but I think they've shown a new way to do it. One of the things that this convention showed is that there is a value in short speeches. This was probably one of the shortest acceptance speeches in modern times. And I thought that Biden benefited from that. He was able to keep it on a level and on a plane that I thought was more effective than if he had gone into a lengthy laundry list of the kind of thing we've seen when speeches go on for 30 minutes or 40 minutes, or in the case of Bill Clinton in 1992, 50 minutes.
Mm-hmm. I want to get you to look ahead before I come to you, Glenn. Look ahead to the Republican National Convention, Dan. What are you after having seen the four nights of the Democratic Convention? What are you expecting to see from the Republicans next week?
My guess, Jonathan, is it will be quite a different convention. For one, they have not done the kind of production work that the Democrats spent months putting together. Next week, a much more of a live event, and without some of the packaging and therefore some of the entertainment value of it. I think the other thing we know is that while it is called the Republican National Convention, it will be the Trump National Convention. Trump will be the centerpiece throughout. And they will probably have some tricks up their sleeve to try to, to top what the Democrats did. I think the other aspect that we should anticipate based on everything we've seen from the campaign so far is there will be a relentless attack against Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and the Democrats in general. I mean, there will be a lot of negativity. Not that there weren't attacks all week from the Democrats aimed at President Trump, but I suspect the tone of it is likely to be different than what we saw this week.
Washington Post reporter Dan Balls, part of a discussion today hosted online by his newspaper. C-SPAN Networks brought you the Democratic Convention gavel to gavel this week. We'll do the same with Republican Convention next week. Starts Monday at 9 p.m. Eastern. And the word is that President Trump will be on site, will be part of every single night. This is Washington Today. A private funeral service for President Trump's younger brother was held today in the East Room of the White House. Robert Trump died last week at the age of 71. The president called Robert not just my brother, he was my best friend. And joining us now to talk about the history and significance of this type of event is Matthew Costello, senior historian at the White House Historical Association. A family funeral at the White House. Has this ever happened before?
Yes, as you could expect, it's happened actually many times in American history. And, one of the things that I point out to people anytime you talk about White House history and the first family is that, even though they're there temporarily, residents are there for 4 years or 8 years, or with FDR, the unusual case, 12 years, but, they are not immune from everyday ordinary things that happen to all families. So whether it's welcoming, a new baby into a family, a grandchild into a family, or is it sons and daughters getting married? Or sometimes, is it family members, immediate family members or other relatives passing away? And the first family experiences those things just like any family in America.
Are there any special protocols or traditions associated with these private events?
Really, I mean, that's dictated by the president and the first lady. So, pretty much every president, I think, except James Garfield, because he passed away, away from Washington, D.C. after he had been shot and he later succumbed to his assassination wound. But pretty much every other president that has been in office, that has passed away in office, has laid in state and had some type of funeral service in the East Room. The three first ladies have also had something very similar. And then also some of the presidential children. So Willie Lincoln, Calvin Coolidge Jr., And then there's also there's been some relatives that, you know, weren't immediate first family members who were actually living at the White House when they passed away, but they didn't actually have a funeral there. So, for example, Frederick Dent, who was Julia Grant's father, and then Bess Truman's mother, Mrs. Wallace. So it's not uncommon to have these types of things happen. And, you know, the White House has been used, you know, everybody thinks of it primarily as, you know, it's the home and the office of the President of the United States. But sometimes they seem to forget that it also has to, it has to find that balance between having a public stage, but then also providing a private residence for the president and his family.
And this is a private service today. Have there been events, like I think not only of funerals, but weddings, there was a prom, although the prom might have been private, where it was sort of a combination. It's a private family event, but it's turned into a public event.
Sure. Yeah. And the one that you referenced was during the Ford administration, when Susan Ford and her class had a prom in the East Room. I think the last time I had looked over it, I think there's been 18 documented weddings at the White House. Some of the more recent ones, you know, Trisha Dixon got married, I think, in 1971. You had the Johnson daughters getting married in the 60s. One actually had the actual service in the White House. The other one just had a reception at the White House. So, yeah, there are these occasions where the first family, you know, because this is where they live, it's technically it's their home for 4 years, that they open it up and they bring in people for celebratory occasions, but then also more solemn occasions.
News reports say that the cost of today's funeral service will be paid by the president himself. Is that the usual procedure?
Yeah, typically, because, you know, this isn't something that, you know, Congress would have had the foresight to appropriate money for. And, you know, historically speaking, going all the way back to when John Adams was the first one to move in, you know, Congress provided a salary for the president, and then they also set aside the initial apportionment was about $14,000. And that was basically given to think of it like furnishing the White House, any other expenditures that come from that. And then if there was any type of maintenance or upkeep that needed to be done, usually they needed a separate congressional appropriation for that. So over time, really, Congress was only allotting money for upkeep, occasionally for major renovation projects when those types of things happen. But when you have these types of things that are very personal events and family events, you know, the President of the United States pays for those things. It's sort of like they pay for their own food bill, for example, because, you know, Congress might appropriate money just for, you know, the household staff, but there are expenditures that the president has to pay out of pocket.
Matthew Costello, senior historian at the White House Historical Association. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And finally, President Trump's former senior strategist, Steve Bannon, today vowing to fight the fraud charges against him. The charges tied to a fundraising campaign to build a portion of a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico.
I have no back down on this. I'm not going to back up one inch. This, all these charges are nonsense. It's a political hit job. I really appreciate the overwhelming support, and including the legal support. You'd be very surprised in the legal community, the number of actually liberal lawyers that have reached out to my legal team. But it's been absolutely fantastic. But there's going to be absolutely no back down in this.
Steve Bannon on his podcast, War Room Today. He and three others were indicted on Thursday for allegedly using hundreds of thousands of dollars donated to an online crowdfunding campaign called We Build the Wall for personal expenses. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. Download the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen anywhere. And remember, this program is available as a podcast at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Have a good night and weekend.